Welcome to the ITAD Talk Podcast with your host, Jeff Bittner.
So welcome to ITAD Talk this morning, and we have a very interesting guest this morning, and his name is Cal Bronstein. And Cal is a proven technology leader with over 30 years of experience designing, building, and evaluating cutting-edge technology platforms in high-pressure, mission-critical environments. He serves as the CEO and Executive Director of Research at RFG, which provides consulting and research for prominent business technology executives and facilitates discussions between leaders of top financial firms and Fortune 500 companies. Prior to leading RFG, he held numerous management positions at IBM and consulted enterprises across the globe. So, Cal, welcome this morning to ITAD Talk.
Oh, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I appreciate you bringing me up.
Great. So one of the questions that I'd like to get into, which I thought was very interesting, is that you were at IBM when Lou Gerstner was CEO, and one of his initiatives was to remove $8 billion in expenses. You were one of the leads on that successful effort. How was he able to cut expenses so significantly?
So great question. It was very interesting. You know, IBM was losing money at the time, and he realized that it wasn't just a matter of improving the top line. It was also cutting costs out of the bottom line. And the challenge of removing $8 billion was a fairly huge challenge. It was a major business transformational effort when you think about it. It was changing the processes that we had, and putting in a lot of new digital technology to drive where the new world was going to be. So the reason he chose to do that is, when you think about it, IBM was a legacy company. And as with all legacy companies, their processes and the technology they use tends to evolve over time and ends up being a patchwork of a lot of different things. And it's not always centrally driven. You have a lot of fiefdoms who do their own thing. So you end up with fiefdoms by product line, by geography, and all different things happening, no coherent consistency across the enterprise. So his objective was to eliminate that and build processes and technology that could be used across the enterprise to make IBM a far more efficient global company than it was, and eliminate all the duplication. So what he did is he created 12 different groups to take a look at all of this. So there was a marketing group, a relationship management group, HR, data, and a whole bunch of different organizations. As we poured through all the different aspects globally, we had a number of teams to do that. And it was about a year's project just to determine where everything was going to be and how it was going to get done and how to build those common processes. And to think about how to do that when you had processes that would apply for a major company or a major country like the United States and a small one like Malta, right? How do you get the same processes working in one place where you have huge number of people and a large group and another which is really, really small, where you don't need all the heavy technology to do that, or even in countries like China, where we worked at, as well, where the cost of individuals was far less and you didn't need to incorporate all that technology. And we went through all of that, and we actually did succeed in taking huge amounts out of the costs and building systems that applied across the board. And one of the things that he made sure he did when doing this, because all the executives needed to be involved, is that we took solutions from each of the geographies and the business units. It was important as a global enterprise to recognize that all the solutions didn't come out of one geography or one business group. It had to come from all the groups. They all had to feel as though they played a fair share in all of it.
You know, just a quick question while you're going into that part of it. What was it like to reposition all the management teams? And, you know, as you mentioned, that with the different parts of the organizations, there's probably some power players in there and some struggle. So I imagine that was kind of an interesting part of it too.
So there was most definitely the biggest challenge, believe it or not, was within the data organization. Everybody recognized in the other groups when we talked about relationship management, opportunity management, and all the other aspects that nobody was doing it perfectly, and recognized that if IBM is going after driving sales, it wasn't just sales for a product. You had to think about upsell and cross-sell and everything else. So there was a lot of working together. However, in the data group, that's where the rubber really hit the road very significantly, because each organization was willing to say, let's do it, but use my databases as the baseline, not theirs. Nobody wanted to change when you think about it. Everybody had their own customer databases, their own formats, their own database systems and approaches to how to do that. And that was the toughest group to work with, and was the only group that did not close on time. They ran beyond the budgeted timeline to finally get to where it needed to be, and it did require senior executive management to force the conclusions on the group.
Wow. So what was it like to work with Lou? What type of a management style was his?
Well, he had come from McKinsey, and so it was very open in terms of there were no limits. In fact, it was very interesting. You know, we went around the world, and one of the things we learned, for example, is how the different geographies approached it. For example, the thing that I always remember is the most interesting is the comparison between how the United States thinks about market planning for the year and Japan. So in the U.S., you know, in January, the teams all get together and they lay out all their marketing plans and what they think they're going to sell and how they're going to work with the customer and all that stuff. And it evolves over the course of the year as things change. In Japan, when they lay out that plan, the intent is that plan will be delivered and every item on that will be checked off when the year is up. Right? Now, their plan normally starts in April rather than January because that's the start of their fiscal year. But when they go through the year, whether the world has changed or not, that plan gets executed in at least on paper. So while it may change, it was always amazing when we'd go in and the first thing they'd report to us is, you know, this was our plan and we met our plan 100%. And then as American, you sat there and said, how's that possible? 12 months later, the world never looks the same. Everything is wrong. Huh. And as you get underneath how people think and how their cultures work and processes, you realize that what you see is not exactly what you get. And I worked on another project in Japan, where it ran late and by a year. And yet on the date it was scheduled to go live, everybody celebrated it's going live. And then they all went back to work for another year to finish the project.
Interesting. So another one of your major accomplishment was the creation of a global contract. Can you tell us what that entailed?
Yeah, so back in those days, IBM, and so did every other company, in fact, had contracts that were by division and by geography. So if you had multiple IBM products, you had multiple IBM contracts. If you had that across multiple geographies, you had them by each contract. So it was conceivable as a customer of IBM, you could have hundreds of IBM contracts, each one for each country and for each product line. The contracts had in it the discounts that you would get, right? And discounts you would get from mainframes and servers were discounts than you would get from software and from PCs. So everything was different. And it was really tough to work with it. And of course, that made it very expensive for procurement people globally, and companies wanted a single contract if they could get it. So we put together a global team and we worked together. It was interesting back in those days, we didn't have all the great capabilities you had now. So I used to get faxes of contracts on an ongoing basis to pour through. And you imagine that you get this massive load of paperwork. It's like Congress today. You get you mark it all up, right? And you send it back to everybody else with a new markup. The waste of paper and fax. But in any event, it was a global team, and we worked every week. We would get the new copies, we'd mark them up and share them, and come to an agreement, and eventually we were able to create a single contract with a which basically had the basic T's and C's in the main part of the contract, and all the global, all the product and country-specific items in the addendums. So that way, depending on where you were, you had the general stuff and you had what applied to you specifically for that unit in your country. And it made it easier now for a company to buy and to work throughout. I would also tell you, by the way, that even though we did that, there were some interesting differences that occurred by country that resulted in local teams and customers buying outside of the contract. For example, in countries, in some of the Asian countries, they expect to get a deep discount no matter what the list price is. So if you imagine PCs may have only had a 6 or 7% discount here, they expected a 40 or 50% discount. So What happened was people would end up marking it up on the outside to a much higher price and then do the discount to get down to where they wanted to be. And all of that was done outside of the contract. So it was very interesting, no matter how you did it, local entities don't always do what corporate wants.
So in a case like that, did that mean that the people that wanted that 40% discount or got that discount were able to have a better pricing power and thereby pull some of the volume from the other areas?
No, they got the same price. So it was jerry-rigged. It's like I intend to sell you something for $50. But the list price is $60. And you say, yeah, that's not good enough. So I come back and say, hey, I have something I list for $100, but I'll give it to 50. And they go, oh, all right, I can sell that to my boss because he expects me to get a 50% discount.
Interesting. Wow.
So it's like, you know, here we do a lot of things with MSRP, right? And
right.
In many
cases,
nobody ever pays it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sit there and say, do I want to have an MSRP of X or Y? Which sells? And then I can discount it because this is what I'm really going to sell it for. So
to kind of circle back to the removal of the $8 billion in expenses, it took you, the team, like a year to create that plan. And then how long did it take to execute and reach those goals?
So that took years. In some cases, what we did is, let me take the HR side. IBM had HR systems that were developed in the US, in Europe, in Asia, in certain countries. So we had 5 or 6 different HR systems. The net result was, after pouring through it, we picked one that was deemed to be the best, but it needed modification. So it took a couple of years to be able to settle on that one, get everybody over to it, move all the data over to it, right? It doesn't, as you would imagine, it doesn't happen overnight. So there's a few year plan for implementation. In that case, it was easy. In some of the product cases, it was far more challenging. And in some cases, things just never could get done.
So a quick question, like on the HR product that you were talking about, since IBM is a computer and a software company, did they create their own modifications to those programs, or is that something that they would sub out to a third-party vendor?
Well, IBM did its own work. They did use some outside consultants here and there, but mostly it was their own. And in some cases, in areas that weren't theirs, the applications they acquired, they bought somebody else's, depending on what they were trying to go. So it was certainly a mix of build and buy and their own and external forces. Most of IBM's employees were not devoted to internal systems, right? That's a corporate group or a set of corporate groups, right? Whereas most of the numbers you think about when you think about the IBM folks, they're devoted to product and services and the sales of those elements, not product support like HR systems. So where they didn't have the skills, in many cases, IBM went out and acquired them.
Okay. Is there anything more you wanted to say about those 2 points before we go on to the next question?
Yeah, I do want to add one other thing on the contract side. One of the things I do find fascinating that people should think about is no matter how big of a company you are, many of the IT vendors, whether it's IBM, Dell, or Amazon, or Microsoft, they are willing in many cases to modify their standard contracts and terms and conditions. People seem to think that they always have to accept exactly what's offered them, and that's not always the case. They will negotiate terms, they'll negotiate prices. It's one of the reasons why Robert Francis Group still does contract work for our clients, because they're willing to make changes. We do a lot of lease related work, and it's very interesting when you try to do a global lease. The companies are extremely flexible, far more than customers think.
Interesting.
Don't forget to subscribe and like the show on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you listen.